Well, good morning. You know, this is a unique experience in that I am preaching this morning, and then this evening the congregation will be getting together to vote to affirm me as interim teaching pastor. So as my daughter said to me just before the service began, "Dad, this is it. Everything rides on this message. No pressure." So, I thought, what would be the best thing to preach on if I want everybody in the congregation to love me? And I thought, stewardship and giving. So we can question my wisdom at another date. Yeah. About 2 weeks ago, Bert and I got together with Peter, John Paulson, and Patrick to talk a little bit about this sermon series in the next couple of weeks. And it was a good conversation. And one of the things, I think it was Patrick or Peter said, you know, RBC already knows what it is to be a disciple. The question that's in our heads is the how. What does it mean to deny oneself? What does it mean to die daily? What does it look like to live this way? And I agree that this church, as a whole, generally speaking, I think understands what it is to be a disciple and what discipleship is. But now I'm just going to speak for myself. I think I understand that to some extent, what it is to be a disciple, what it is to follow Jesus in the way that he's called us to. But man, do I fall short of that so often. And I know this is just me, all are fine, but just because I know it doesn't mean I don't need to be reminded of this call time and time again. And this series, as Bert and I have been going through it, I know for me, particularly this week, and all of them actually, I've just been convicted. I am preaching beyond my obedience. This is a world in which I know I need to live more faithfully. Now, don't mishear me. I don't think I'm carousing on the streets when I'm not standing up here. But I know my Savior has more for me. And I have a long way to go before I look more like him. Also, what does it look like? What do we do? Sometimes the text is pretty clear. Sometimes not so much. I know that we are creatures of habits. All too often we have beliefs or practices that are almost instinctive. We've always done it this way. Or just in a twitch or a habit that you might have that you do every single morning that you don't remember who taught you how to do it, but it's just what you do. Those things that get ingrained, we tend to not evaluate. It tends to be kind of out of sight, out of mind, because it's habitual. And as we're looking at a touchy subject and a difficult parable this morning, I encourage us all to reflect well. That's a really hard thing to do, to reflect well and to think critically and Christianly about what it is we are called to do and how we are to do it. Last week, Bert preached on what it is to be stewards of the way, capital Way, stewards of this call to Christianity and evangelism and service, our times, our time, our talents, our treasures, dedicated to him. So this morning, I'm going to look at another text dealing with specifically finance and money and stewardship. And my goal is, as we look at this text, that we get a gauge. We have a meter that we can use to evaluate, at least in this area, how we are doing. Are we moving towards the ideal that Christ has for us, or are we consciously or unconsciously resisting it? And we're going to do that by looking at this passage, Luke 16, which is so encouraging. After I wrestled with the text and put together my thoughts on the sermon, I go to commentaries to see how wrong I am. And almost every single commentary started with a line along this. This is by far the hardest and most difficult of the parables to understand. I agree with those commentators after wrestling with this text. But we need to look at it in context, right? Luke 16, from what I understand, one of the professors at DTS, Jim Allman, taught me this. Luke 16 is right between Luke 15 and Luke 17. Right? And so we can't move too far away from that context. Bert was in 14, where he talked about the cost of discipleship. And then 15 comes in, and we get this flood of parables from Jesus. The first one is the parable of the lost sheep. The next one is the parable of the lost coin. And then the third one, the parable of the prodigal son. And in these three parables, we see, through Jesus' teaching, divine action, divine rescue, and divine joy over the found coin, the found sheep, the found son. And then we go directly into 16, where we have the parable of the dishonest manager, then addressing specifically the Pharisees in light of that parable, and then the story of the rich man and Lazarus. So now the focus shifts from divine action to human responsibility to eternal reward. This is all in a big chain. So we need to have this in the back of our mind as we're reading. So let's start with verse 1. Interesting little note. If you remember, at the very beginning of 14, or at 14:25, where Bert started, now great crowds accompanied him, and he turned and said to them. So he's speaking to all the crowds. And then we get to 16, verse 1. He also said to the disciples. So he spoke to the crowds, and the crowds are still there. And he turns his attention to the 12. He turns his attention to his disciples and says, there was a rich man. An interesting thing to do. The full group of folks were still there, particularly the Pharisees, and he narrows his focus to the disciples. And as we'll see, this is a very intentional and strategic move by Jesus. There was a rich man who was informed of accusations that his manager was wasting his assets. This context, again, that word wasting is the same word that's used in chapter 15 about the prodigal son. The son wasted, squandered, scattered his inheritance. It's the same verb here. The manager was squandering, wasting, scattering. So there we go. Wonderful. We need to put ourselves in a first century mindset. When we hear there was a rich man, the first thing that comes to our mind is Fiddler on the Roof. And once we get past that, we think about people who have worked hard and have pulled themselves up and have done great things. And the rich man, often in our context, is someone that we respect and we have sympathy or affection for. Not always. In the first century, that was not the case. And in a parable, Jesus doesn't have time to do full character development. And if you read the literature of the period, when they're telling parables for this purpose, it's when rabbis are doing this, they're using these default characters. So when they say there was a rich man, they instantly have a picture in their mind. They lived in a fixed economy. There was only so much to go around. And ideally, everyone would have enough. That's the goal. So if there was a rich man among so many poor, this means that he has taken somehow what is not rightfully his and left other people to suffer. And one of the ways this was done is by these landowners that leased to tenants. And the picture of
The rich get richer because they are creditors, and the poor become poorer because they are debtors. So we aren't to think of the rich man as a good man, necessarily, in this parable. And then we get to this manager who is wasting his assets. We need to have a first century view of what that manager would be, what the steward would be. And I thought this was really interesting. I read, just recreationally, a second century account of the type of authority these people would have. And there's a writer named Columella who gives the description. If you were writing a job description for a steward of your property, this is what you'd want to have. Someone who is competent, faithful, bears goodwill and affection to the owner, and is illiterate. Well, that's interesting. The purpose of the illiteracy, and this you're going to see how this applies directly to the text in a moment. The purpose of the illiteracy, he said, if he does not know his letters, he is less able to falsify accounts because he would have to include someone else in to help him falsify, which brings someone else in to the deception. So illiterate is a good thing to have. And so if you're looking for someone to manage your assets, look for somebody who can't read or write. No. Now, another interesting thing about the steward, if the steward does wrong, it's not viewed as the steward's fault. It's the manager's or the owner's fault, because the owner is the one who put him in that position. He should have known better. Or he's the one who has left him in that position. He needs to remove him. So it is in the owner's best interest to hire men of character and to be swift when a hole is revealed, when there's a problem. And so here we see the owner doing just that. He calls the manager in and says, "What is this I've heard of you?" This means this is going around. People are talking about how much this manager is wasting. So he gets fired. But he's not out the door yet. He needs to prepare the accounts to turn them over so the owner can see how horribly he abused the system, and then to give it to the next individual who will hopefully steward and manage responsibly. So that's when this story gets interesting. This is a hard parable. There was an emperor, Julian, Emperor Julian. One of the primary reasons he stated for rejecting Christianity is this parable. He said, "How can I follow a teacher who commends this type of thinking?" His name in history now is Julian the Apostate. But that's how troublesome this story is. I'm not saying I have the answer, but I think I have an answer. Not the and. We'll see. The manager said to himself, "What should I do, since my master is taking my position away from me? I'm not strong enough to dig, and I am ashamed to beg." He's grown used to his cushy desk job and having some liquid expendable income. And the "I'm too ashamed to beg," that's really pride, isn't it? He's thinking, "How can I hit the streets to beg, sitting among the men and women I used to collect debts from? I'm ashamed to do that. I have to be better than that. I have to be different than that." So he's looking for the light bulb to turn on. And it does in verse 4. And this is one of those things in the Greek where there's this phrasing, this way the word is composed. I know what to do. It's kind of the aha, eureka. I know what I can do when I'm put out of management, so people will welcome me into their homes. Another translation of that, receive me into their households. What he is plotting here, what he is planning, he's never going to get a job managing again. His name is going to be destroyed. But if he can twist things around so that he can become a professional house guest, he'll be set. So this isn't just, "Yeah, come on in for dinner." This is receive him into their homes. So hopefully you haven't had that experience where you had a house guest who stayed for maybe a day, week, year too long. But that's what he is planning on doing here with this solution. So he speaks to the master's debtors one by one. And that phrase, one by one, indicates he didn't just talk to two people. He was talking to all of them one by one by one. And we're given the two to give us the type of conversations he was having. Now, here's where I really wrestled through studying this. How much do you owe? 100 measures of oil. Tell you what, write down 50. We'll be good. Most of the folks I was reading and what I was wrestling through, Jesus later commends this guy for being shrewd in this practice. How can we reconcile Jesus, the Holy One, the righteous one, who can do no wrong, with commending something that seems just absolutely defrauding and illegitimate and dangerous and sinful? We're missing something here. And people would come up with different ideas and how, well, Jesus was talking about this aspect, not this aspect. And it just seemed like a lot of gymnastics. And then I did some digging into how debt was handled in the Jewish system. There's a dirty word in Judaism called usury. We call it interest. You are not allowed to charge interest on a debt. That would be great, wouldn't it? I think America should embrace this aspect of Judaism. But interest was forbidden. It was wrong. So put that in the back of your head. The next one, 100 measures of olive oil. Sit down, write 50. The next one, 100 measures of wheat. Take your bill, write down 80. Notice it's a different number. Why is it a different number? Why wouldn't he just cut everybody's bills in half? I think that's where we're going to see why Jesus was able to commend this guy. Right? Another thing to think of, when I've read this passage in the past, I have in mind the rich man, the rich landowner, and these poor peasants who are scraping out a living desperately from the soil, barely making enough to keep their families alive. 100 measures of olive oil, 100 measures of wheat, based on the word used for measurements for those two concepts, these lots, in order to have that kind of rent or charge on them, would be 20 times larger than the usual plot of land that somebody would work. So these folks are well off. The rich man is more well off, but these folks are well off. So it makes sense. The steward is wanting to make friends with these people, so he has a nice, comfortable place to go. All right. So what do we do with these numbers? The manager is not making accomplices. He's not bringing the debtors into a shared guilt with him by kind of going, I'll tell you what, I'm turning these books over. He's not going to see what we're doing here, but I'll cut your debt in half if you'll remember me after I'm on the streets. And the debtor goes, you know what? That sounds pretty good. I'm in. You're sure we won't get caught? He's not making accomplices. He's making friends. So here's the kicker. The unrighteous manager, the unjust steward, the irresponsible one here is doing something that's ethical and permissible. He's not manipulating, twisting, or stealing yet again from his master. 50% of the olive oil, 20% of the wheat. Those are the standard rates of interest that would be charged to someone for those resources outside of the Judaic system. And the manager, this was unfortunately common practice, the way that he supplemented his income, and other managers would do the same, it doesn't look like interest if when you give the loan, you write down the value in commodity instead of the value in money. So they were given money, finances, that would equal 80 units. And charged interest for 20 units, transferred to a commodity, 100 units of wheat. So effectively, usury or interest was charged. Olive oil, the standard tax, 50%. They were given money that was roughly the value of 50 baths of olive oil. Charged interest for 50. It's written as a commodity, doesn't look like interest anymore. So what the manager has done is he's taken this debt and he's lopped the interest off, the portion that he would have been able to keep as his commission, more or less. He sacrificed the money that could have been his to invest in his future, to make sure he had a place. And in doing so, he's making himself and the master look good. Because, no, we're not charging you interest. Why would we do that? We're not. This is what we gave you. This is what you return. So here, in this instance, the wicked, unjust, dishonest steward is doing the right thing. This was difficult for me to swallow until I did that digging and I saw those interest rates. And it explains, nothing is in Scripture by accident. Why do we have these two examples, and one at 50% and one at 20%? It aligns beautifully. And if you were a first century Jew listening to this message, you would know about usury being illegal, and you'd know what the standard interest rates would be. So this would have been understood by the audience at the time. So just to tie it together, to draw the dots here, the master commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. All right, so is this the master that's talked about in the story? I don't think so. Because the word that is used in Luke, ha kurios, the Lord, is almost always used of Jesus when Luke is talking. And when kurios is used in the parable, there's always a pronoun in front of it. His master. So separating it. And it doesn't make much sense for this to come so closely together. The master, I would argue, Jesus, commended the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their contemporaries than the people of light. The first word of that sentence, for the people of this world. For connects that sentence to the previous sentence. So it's the same voice. And it would make no sense for the master in the story to say this because he's one of the people of this world. He wouldn't speak of himself that way. So this is where Jesus' commentary begins. So this shrewdness that this person used. Let's go back to the past several sermons. So this is a quick speed recap for all of you. Those who do not renounce all that they possess are not able to be his disciples. Luke 14:33. Store up treasures for God by selling the temporary possessions and giving alms to the poor. Luke 12. This wealth is not something that we should pursue. It's something we should use, right? We go to Matthew 10:16, and we get that strange saying that you need to be as wise as serpents. Were serpents favorably viewed by the Jewish people in history? I'm going to say there was an incident pretty early on that made serpents not a favorite thing. So a serpent is a strange model to use for wisdom. This dishonest steward is a strange model to use to be a model of financial thinking and forethought. But the contrast is one of the things that makes it so compelling, and also they both possess a characteristic that we as Christians need: prudence. We need to be able to do what this unrighteous steward did. He recognized what was on the horizon, and he acted swiftly to prepare for the future. He saw what was coming. He acted swiftly to prepare for the future. Should not disciples live in such a way that they act shrewdly or decisively in how they invest in others with the view of the future, the eternal world that is to come. So Jesus continues with his commentary, verse 9. And I tell you, make friends for yourselves by how you use worldly wealth, so that when it runs out, you will be welcomed into the eternal homes. You know, the phrase that's used, worldly wealth, some of your translations are going to say unrighteous mammon. That's not a phrase that rolls off the 21st century tongue, so they changed it to worldly wealth. But Jesus viewed anything that wasn't focused on the Father as being idolatry. If you remember, the very first sermon of this series was on having a supreme love for Jesus, a love so high, everything else pales in comparison. If anything else is in that seat, whether it be your career, money, ministry, your children, you have turned that into an idol, unrighteous mammon. Wealth can be itself not evil, but your pursuit of it can be unrighteous. So the steward, look for the connection, the steward used money that he wasn't his, but for which he had responsibility to secure his next life, what was coming next. Do you see where I'm going with this? We are called to use the resources that we've been given that are not ours to invest in what's coming. So how do we do that? I want to quickly hit four things in Luke 16:10 and following where we have some principles for finances that can inform us how we use our money, and then I'm going to have a very practical application that I pray that you would consider doing this week. So first, Luke 16:10, the one who is faithful in very little is also faithful in much, and the one who is dishonest in very little is also dishonest in much. It's interesting here because the unrighteous steward wasn't faithful in anything, right? But money, here's the principle, money is a little issue. It doesn't matter in the big scheme of things, but it is loaded with implications. How we use our money, how we use our resources, is a reflection of our heart and our priorities. I think of it, I never drink coffee out of a percolator. It's not the best way to drink coffee. But if you have to, on the front of the percolator, there's that glass, right, where you can see how full the percolator is, that sight glass. That's money in the life of the Christian. How you are using your resources is an indicator of the state of your heart, your affections, and your priorities. Keep reading here. If then you haven't been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will entrust you with the true riches? Faithfulness right now with the treasures we've been given will reveal itself in the future as treasures we can't imagine in heaven. That's not why we do it. We don't do it for treasure. We do it for love and thanks for what has been done for us. But it doesn't change the reality that faithfulness now results in great beauty later. And if you haven't been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you your own? Trustworthy stewardship will be rewarded with real ownership. There will come a day when we will be truly free, standing before the presence of our God. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. Notice he says, doesn't say you should not serve God and money. He says you cannot. If you were a slave in the first century and you had two masters, you would like one better than the other. It's just human nature. It shifts. Money and God are mutually exclusive priorities. You can't love them both. The idea is that, are we using God to get money, Or are we using our money in the service of God? This isn't an anti-money sermon. This is a priorities sermon. Just a quick hit on verse 15, 14 and 15. Most people stop at 13, but, you know, I'm a completionist. The Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this and ridiculed him. Notice he was talking to his disciples, but the Pharisees were right there. Jesus said to them, "You are the ones who justify yourselves in men's eyes, but God knows your hearts. For what is highly prized among men is utterly detestable in God's sight." So it's possible that the Pharisees viewed money as a reward for their faithful service. But look at the Pharisees throughout the Gospels, and what do we see? They are very focused on how they are viewed. We are righteous. We obey the law. Listen to my prayers. They were focused on an earthly treasure, what others would think of them. This isn't just money. What are you working for? Something temporal that is going to fade away in the end, or something eternal that will never fade? So here is the practical application. Y'all familiar with the Capital One credit card advertisement? What's in your wallet? This is the last Sunday in June. We are 6 months into the calendar year. This week, I want you to sit down and spend some time with your financial statements, credit card, bank, etc., in front of you. And I want you to evaluate your spending. Review what has come in and what has gone out, and for what. Does your income and your outgo reflect your heart and your priorities? If someone were to look at what's going out and what is being spent and where the money is hitting, what would they say are the priorities in your life? This is a hard and painful thing to do, but do this and that. Pray that God would reveal to you how he would have you use his resources for the next 6 months. This isn't a matter of reviewing your giving. This is a matter of reviewing your living. I'm not suggesting you look and see how much you've given to churches and parachurch organizations and stop there. I'm saying look at your finances and what does it say about your priorities and your heart. The local church is the primary place where giving occurs. And then from there, as the Lord leads, you give to parachurch organizations and other missions agencies and so on. What does that look like? So, final thought. We've been given much. We've been given so much. We're sitting in an air-conditioned building in Dallas, Texas. This is a blessing. Many of us have vehicles that brought us here, homes in which we live, food that we eat, maybe not the kind of food or as much food as we would like, but we have food. You have a life that you have been given. How are you spending that? Does it reflect your heart and priorities? Are you willing to transfer everything you are and everything you have from the account of ownership to the account of stewardship? Let me pray for us. Heavenly Father, you are the giver of every good gift. You are the one who owns the cattle on 1,000 hills and the hills upon which they stand. We are simply recipients of what is yours. And it hasn't become ours. It is still yours. I pray for myself that I would look at where I spend my resources, my time, my money, and prayerfully evaluate what is this saying about my heart and my priorities. I pray that RBC, as a church body, would be a church that lives for the Son, that does not focus on self-advancement and personal growth and wealth, but instead views the precious gifts you've given us of life and the money that you've entrusted to us, that we would view these things as tools to be used for your glory for the sake of the kingdom. I pray that you would use the gifts of time and finances that the men and women in this room give. I pray that you would use them in a way that glorifies you and makes you known. I pray for the missionaries that we financially support, that you would encourage them, that you would embolden them, and that you would equip them from our prayers and from our giving to boldly proclaim your gospel in places where we could never go. I pray for your church. This church is the bride of your Son. I pray that we would prepare ourselves so that when our bridegroom comes, he would look and say, "Well done, good and faithful servants." We commit all of this to you in the name of your Son and the power of your Spirit. Amen.